I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome to Beyond the Spin. It's post-election day, and we've been together now for 14 episodes looking at this election from the perspective of stations, that, or community stations from around the United States of America. We're joined by some folks who have been with us before and some who have not today, I should say. Michael Maluski is with us from Alaska, Chief Operating Officer at KVRF in Palmer, Alaska, and former city council member in Palmer, Alaska. Heather Nidea is with us, and she's news director and host of the Noon Hour magazine at Allegheny Mountain Radio, serving the Allegheny Highlands in Virginia and West Virginia. Marcus Hiles is with us. He's senior news correspondent at WVAS in Montgomery, Alabama. And Davey D., host of Hard Knock Radio, a daily drive-time hip-hop talk show on KPFA in Berkeley, California. And folks, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So it was an interesting election last night. Before we get into the larger national picture and what you think it says from your community's perspective about where we're going and what this election said to everybody, other than the fact that Barack Obama won and Democrats kept the Senate and all the straight political stuff, I'm just curious, from where you are, from the communities you live in, what is the response to this election, and what was it like there leading up to this election? Michael?
Thanks. Well, I prepped for this by spending the last hour in our local coffee shop where many different people flow through.
And just, the best way to do it.
The anecdotal, it was important to do, and there you have to understand when you look at the big map, the color that Alaska has as compared to, say, Hawaii. And there were some local statewide elections that went in a very different way, very much in the direction of supporting Republican candidates to the legislature. Basically, President Obama did not take the state of Alaska, and he did, however, receive something over 40%, maybe 41% of the vote, which is kind of an interesting thing. You have large pockets of people that looked at this and were very happy. There was dancing in the coffee house, absolutely. And there were other people that had glum faces. And I think it's reflective of, as I talk to people both there this morning and previous to the election, that even those who were more conservative, and they looked at Governor Romney, and they had questions. And these are people I would consider to be moderately conservative, because they raised the question about who is this guy. And I think if anything that emerged, at least from Alaska at this point, is that whether you liked him or not, Obama was definable. The big characteristic that gave people pause, I believe, around his opponent, Governor Romney, was that shifting, shimmering image that seemed to appear throughout the campaign.
And Heather, I mean, West Virginia also went Republican for president, though there was a mix on other votes. Talk about, because your four counties that you broadcast to have been very interesting. So talk a bit about what's happening there.
Well, actually, you know, the voting was really not much of a surprise last night. It was kind of what we expected to see. West Virginia, of course, did go red. They went quite a bit for Romney, and actually it was kind of interesting. I was looking at the state totals or percentages for Romney versus Obama compared to Pocahontas County. They're actually very close. In the state, Romney took about 62% of the vote for the presidential, and that's very similar to what he did in Pocahontas County. So it was kind of interesting. But there again, like you said, we went red for the presidential race. Most of the other races went to Democrats. We reelected a Democratic governor. Senator Joe Manchin was elected to a full six-year term as a Democrat. Here in District 3, which includes Pocahontas County, we reelected the Democratic candidate there. And this is despite the congressman, the senator, and the governor all taking pains to distance themselves from the Obama administration earlier this year. because they kind of knew that if they were tied to Obama, that they would have had a much more difficult time winning their elections last night. Bath and Highland counties, really no surprises there. Both counties went heavily for the Republican candidate for the president. So they both went for Romney. Virgil Goode, who ran as a Constitution candidate, really turned. There were some concerns that he might take some votes away from Mr. Romney, but he really turned out to be a non-factor last night. Didn't really garner much of the vote at all. So, I think the biggest surprise, as far as Virginia is concerned, came last night when, in the Senate race, when George Allen conceded by 11 o'clock p.m. last night, he was conceding to his Democratic rival Tim Kaine, and that kind of came as a surprise because there were still quite a few votes still outstanding at that point.
So now we've been talking to folks at WVAS in Alabama a great deal. Marcus Hiles joins us from there now. And one of the things we talked about was the Roy Moore race for Supreme Court Justice, the Ten Commandments controversy and God's will. So
right.
But he won.
He did. He did, and it was I can't say that it was shocking because the state is so red. We're candy apple red. And it has been that way for quite some time now. It's very interesting living in the state as long as I have to watch it go from very Democratic and then to just transition over the years to highly conservative to watch that happen. But it's an interesting story that you bring up, Mark, because he was ousted from office. A lot of people probably know the history of Roy Moore when he brought in the Ten Commandments monument. Which is a 5,200-pound granite monument that was placed in the Supreme Court building, which was ultimately what got him ousted when he refused to remove it. Now, he has failed in two gubernatorial attempts since then. So in that sense, it was a little bit of a surprise because he hasn't been having much success trying to get back into the political arena. But I don't want to say that the Democratic opponent in the primary was weak, but obviously Roy Moore, I think it really did kind of slip up on everybody when he won handily in the primary. And then the Democratic Party took a very interesting tactic when they removed their own candidate who won the primary. Found a reason, I don't know exactly, can't remember exactly what the reason was, but they removed him because of some I want to say technical difficulty per se that they took him away and brought in Judge Bob Vance, a Democrat, to run against Roy Moore, and he managed to put on a very good campaign. And just that was since August that he's been mounting this campaign, and he made it a pretty close race. I believe he got about 48% of the vote, and Moore ended up winning 52%. So such a little time, the Democratic candidate did come close to this, but. We are making history. Moore is now our Chief Justice elect.
Yeah, let's see where that takes Alabama.
He's promised not to put in another Ten Commandments monument. He has. But we'll see.
Now David E., I mean, you are representing, at least for today, the blue state in all this. I was really interested in watching the referendums in California as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, there's a couple of things to look at. I don't really like to get into the conversations of red and blue in the sense that it implies that the entire makeup of a particular place thinks that way. I think a lot of things are very purple and we just happen to have a winner-take-all situation. And so it can be very misleading when you say it's all red and it's all blue.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, California is a strongly Democratic state. I think there were many people that are here up and down the state that were happy to see the reelection of Barack Obama. But that doesn't begin to really tell the type of story that exists. I think there's a real unhappiness with the amount of money that has allowed folks to come in and play baseball, so to speak, while others have to sit at the side and be at the mercy of a particular proposition or a particular candidate that has huge war chest. behind him or her. And I think in some of the propositions you saw a rejection of that. That was Proposition 32 with Charles Munger, and Proposition 38 going down in flames with his sister, Molly Unger. At the same time, you saw how money played a big role in the GMO labeling situation with Monsanto and Coca-Cola and, you know, other agribusinesses playing, putting tens of millions of dollars into a proposal at a state that is arguably a green capital type of state. I mean, we can talk about going into, you know, any neighborhood, you know, it could be the hood or it could be the suburbs, and people are all about, you know, green gardening and all that. So to see that that proposition didn't pass, and then to see the NAACP, of all people, actually come and support Monsanto just tells you how deep the pockets are when it comes to certain types of corporations. So I say all that to say that I think for the folks that I know, the re-election of Barack Obama just gives you a little bit of time to, you know, maybe get some things done and to fortify a different type of movement before it becomes business as usual. And when I say business as usual, meaning that corporate influence has been driving a lot of politics for a very long time, at least in terms of some of the policies that we seem championed. And it's becoming kind of repressive for a lot of folks. And so I think with him being reelected, it's like, okay, that's good. It's much better than going to the far right, as it would have done if Romney and his team had gotten into office. What does that mean for us? It means redefining things on your own terms. It means redefining how you are going to exist with your neighbor. Are we going to continue to play a winner-take-all type of scenario, or are we going to try to find ways in which we can coexist together and be more cooperative in our efforts, in our collective efforts? And so those are things that I think folks are trying to figure out. And I say that also noting that you have a blackening and a browning of the demographics that are now coming out to vote. That's what put Barack Obama over the top. You also have a younger group of people that are also at the short end of the stick. A lot of students are sitting there going, I'm paying 300% more in tuition increases and with more to come. You know, that was one of the big things around Proposition 30 that folks had to fight to get past just to stave off those tuition increases. You have a chancellor that sat up there and said people who spend more than 4 years in college are gaming the system and they are lazy, overlooking the fact that many people are working two and three jobs and seeing their parents and you know, have to foreclose on their houses and things like that, which has put them under the gun. So these types of realities where basically people conclude that they don't really count at the end of the day, or they're rendered invisible or disposable, I think has made people really have to take a long, hard look at those who are professing to speak on their behalf, politicians or pundits, as well as, you know, what the political reality is in terms of policy, which gets championed and which doesn't. And I think people are taking that very seriously and will continue. It might not always show up at the polls, but I think it definitely shows up in terms of how people are now trying to, the types of conversations that people are having. And so Barack Obama gives you a you know, there was some dancing in the streets, but I think people are now rolling up their sleeves and going, you know, that dancing in the streets was just for the moment. Time to get to work.
Well, you raised some interesting issues here, David D, in some broader senses that go beyond our localities, but our localities, you're correct, are all split in some ways or another. And I think you saw a push, whether it's from the right or the left and other places as well, that people are kind of weary of this, the power of huge money in politics in many ways. And so, you know, and I mean, in places like Alaska, Michael, I mean, which is has this known for a kind of an independent streak as a state, at least that's the mythology, if not some of the reality as well. I mean, that's part of the issue. I'm wondering how that plays out there. I mean, because even though it went overwhelmingly Republican, as you said, I mean, it was a much larger vote on the other side than you thought. So I'm curious how you think what you heard David D plays out in terms of your world.
Well, let me throw out a couple of things. First of all, one word, three letters, oil. That makes us different. We've got somewhere north of $40 billion in a permanent fund. Oil drives everyone's attention. continue to represent the state. They have to deal with the issue of oil drilling, whether it's offshore or in other areas. It's interesting, maybe this is the best example, in the state legislature, the governor has been working that legislature because, as a Republican, he has had an interest in encouraging development of further oil drilling, et cetera, in the state. He's been frustrated somewhat because, and I'm not quite sure how it happened, but it did happen, that the state Senate, which consists of 20 people, has been, over the last few years, run by a coalition of D's and R's, who have successfully had dialogue around how to incentivize oil companies. And that was the core focus for the statewide election, basically whether that coalition would survive. Individuals were targeted in primaries. The money you spoke about came in from outside, from large corporate interests. And basically, it looks right now, day after, that coalition will cease to exist. And there's been a number of people, because we have independent voters, large group of people that don't associate with either party, that are concerned about balancing what incentives, read tax incentives, et cetera, that are given to oil companies that apparently are doing pretty well here, and balancing that off. So that's going to be everything that we'll be talking about in the next year up here. The fact that the president has been reelected plays out in the question of how is he going to deal with an area, the northern part of the state, Anwar, offshore drilling, and all the rest of it. That just is so big an issue that everything else sort of fades into the background.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, the question that I think really rests in many ways on where this goes from here, and some of the things David D. was saying, what you just said, Michael. I mean that there's a complexity to how elections are being playing out in terms of money and power and who.
Can I say something with respect to where it goes from here? We didn't really talk about it, and I also kind of define community a little differently. We were talking specifically about region. So in California, there's a California outlook. But I think for people in my generation, community is defined in much more fluid ways, and it crosses boundaries and borders and what have you. And one of the big things that played out this year was voter suppression and the tactics used. And that wasn't going unnoticed. That's why, you know, people stood on long lines for 6 and 7 hours and dealt with, you know, aggressive folks literally accusing them of voter fraud when, gosh, it was hard enough just to get people to vote at one point in time. Now you have this, you know, conspiracy theory that there's massive voter fraud angered a lot of folks, because what cut to the chase of it was an undercurrent of racism and an undercurrent of disempowering folks. And it really sent a strong message to, one, I'm not going to let you do this. So I'll show up if I need to, and I'll endure, you know, standing in the cold for a few hours if I have to, and I'll endure seeing my favorite radio station put up billboards in my own community, you know, talking about voter fraud and all these types of things that really piss people to hell off. And I think one question that, you know, one thing that people have been talking about, these elections got to be reformed. You can't have a hodgepodge of different rules. You can't have you can have a driver's license here, but you don't have to. You can have a hunting license over here. When I went to vote, I didn't need no ID in California. You know, I just walk up and say, "This is who I am. This is where I live. My name's on the list," and that's that. And so that becomes very problematic. The amount of money that goes into the election, that becomes a big thing. And then you have just the very blatant deceptive practices, even here. In the Bay Area, when we woke up, thousands of people in San Francisco had a flyer that was remade for, using the logo and the exact endorsements of people that were featured on this Democratic Club flyer, except the only thing that was changed was Prop 37, which was the GMO one. That was changed from a yes to a no. And so people didn't necessarily know if that was really the case. They bring their little scorecard to the ballot, to the ballot booth, and they look and they go, I guess my Democratic barometer for how I should go is going this way, so I'll go this way as well. That shouldn't have been happening. And it just becomes a real sad commentary on us as a society, especially when we sat up on the world stage and we talked about how we want to go around to different parts of the world and democratize them, and, you know, what leader needs to be sitting in to, you know, what office and what country and how responsible they can be, when we had this sort of massive attack on people, primarily in communities that are poor and communities of color, that just was, I think, over the top. And so I think, you know, there will be a push, you know, for people to try and figure out how you can reform elections. And, you know, and that's something that we shouldn't dismiss.
And again, let's go back to some other states here, because I think what David is describing had an idea. I mean, West Virginia was, if I'm correct here, was big on closing down early voting.
It was reduced. We went from about 14 days down to 10 days this year. And I actually asked the county clerk about that yesterday. That came about as a result of one of the many special elections we'd had in the last couple years, because we had after Senator Byrd died, we had a governor who assumed his office, and that meant we had a special election for a governor and then a special election for the Senate position, and it was just been kind of a nightmare for the last couple years. But there was, I've heard several points there that I kind of wanted to touch on, too.
Please do.
What Michael was saying about the three-letter word in Alaska. Well, we've got a three-letter word, and we've got a four-letter word in West Virginia. The four-letter word, of course, is coal. I mean, coal is king here. And natural gas is also becoming a very big thing in West Virginia. It's really, like Pennsylvania, it's getting a lot more development, especially in the northern part of the state. And that is something that people pay a lot of attention to. I mean, with the Obama's administration, well, not even there, the Obama administration, with the EPA's kind of crackdown on coal emissions and that sort of thing, that really kind of got the backup of the governor, of the people of the state. I mean, I don't know how many signs I saw throughout this campaign season of coal is king, fire Obama. So, and that's part of the reason why you saw our Democratic governor, our Democratic senator, our Democratic congressman taking great pains to distance themselves from the administration. I mean, they all three, none of them went to the Democratic convention this past summer. That was just one example of them trying to put that little a bit of distance there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was really interested when I was, something David touched on too, talking about the blackening and the browning of American voters. I was kind of watching the returns in Virginia and going through and looking county by county and city by city last night as the presidential returns were coming in. And it was really interesting. It was almost a rural versus urban kind of situation. The rural counties, especially, heavily Republican. But the urban centers, especially places like Richmond, Virginia, Petersburg, Virginia, other cities, Northern Virginia, of course, but especially those places where you had a heavier African-American population, heavily Democratic, which tells me a couple things. One, that's a good reflection of that changing electorate, but it also shows me that perhaps the Obama team did a better job of motivating their base to get out there and cast those ballots. Because in some places it was quite dramatic. I think in Richmond, the returns were, it was like a 4-1 ratio for President Obama last night. So it was really interesting to watch that. And I actually heard a comment from somebody this morning who is a lifelong Democrat, and it was just kind of an off-the-cuff comment, but he said, you know, the Republican Party needs to realize that America's not being run by white men anymore. And I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well, I mean, Bill O'Reilly said that pretty much last night.
Is this Marcus?
When he talked about traditional America was being removed. I think, you know, I'll give some credit that there was the motivating of the base, but there was a lot of dissatisfaction with Barack Obama, and we need to be very honest about that. It was just maybe a couple of months out that people was like, pretty much, man, I'm not even voting for this guy, because, you know, in many communities, in black communities, he hasn't really addressed key issues. He's been perceived as somebody who wants to kowtow to the mainstream. In brown communities, at least like here, you had like over 1 million deportations. And deportations mean that families get broken up. It's not like somebody who's a stranger, who's not connected to people who live here, cross these borders for whatever reason. And so, and this is after he promised not to have that happen, and he did a lot of these deportations in states that are that have sanctuary cities, like California. I say that all to say that I don't know if people were as motivated as one might think, as they were really pissed off and angry that there was folks who were trying to disempower them, and there was that racial undercurrent. That's what got picked up. It's like you see this fight around early voting. You see this fight around IDs, and, you know, whether it's stated or not, people perceive it as like, I know what this is about. You don't have to say it. It's about my color of the skin and the fact that I may be potentially a political ally, so you're going to target me. And when these things started to play out, you saw that they were actually targeting folks, and that really got people pissed off to the point that they showed up. If you talk about women, the war on women, and what's rape and legitimate rape and all that other sort of stuff, there was way too many women that I know that was like, I will just vote on GP. I'm going to pull the lever for this guy because he's smart enough not to say it. And I think some of those senators who made these remarks, whether they were in context or taken out of, may have also motivated some of those bases in key places. And flip that election, especially when it's as close as it is. You know, what Murdoch had to say, what Aikens had to say, it might not have played out in their respective states, but I think because it had such a national coverage, that a lot of folks in other places were like, I will go to the polls and I will pull the lever. Like, my mom was like, I'm in a wheelchair, but I'm going to go because I don't want these type of people, you know, disrespecting, you know, me as a woman. And I think, you know, we can't underestimate that type of anger to what was a backlash with people who are angry at folks who, in their mind, I didn't really do anything except just be who I am, so, a person of color.
I Heather, go ahead. I do want to get Marcus back in this conversation, but we haven't heard from him in a bit. But let me just ask Marcus a quick question, and then Heather, I want you to come right back in. Because when I look at Alabama, and I'm hearing what everybody is saying here, and I think there's a lot of argument back and forth from people about what motivated voters, and I think and why communities of color voted for Obama overwhelmingly. But in Alabama, it was a situation where the Republicans won every major race, but you can see that playing out in the map of who voted in Alabama, where in the cities and in what's commonly known as the Black Belt of Alabama, where the black community has lived rurally and talks about the earth more than the color of the people, but that was overwhelmingly for Democrats. I mean, so you can see that divide playing out in Alabama.
Absolutely. In fact, what Heather was saying rang true for me when she was saying it, that it's very much all of the rural areas of this state are quite Republican, and the urban areas you're going to have more Democratic. So it's almost the same as she was saying. I wanted to clarify also earlier when I was talking about how cherry red our state is, which is true. There is a 38% group of folks that voted for President Obama who are passionate. They are certainly not as numerous, but they are every bit as passionate as the conservative group in the state. So I wanted to make that clarification. Also wanted to build on a couple of other things that y'all were saying. Also on the question of funding. And I'm playing a little catch-up here, if y'all don't mind.
No, that's cool.
As far as funding, I spoke with Lucy Baxley, who was the president of our Public Service Commission here in the state. And, Mark, you were talking about there are no more Democratic state office holders in Alabama. As of last night, she was the last one. And she was voted out. Twinkle Andrus Kavanaugh is our new Republican public service commissioner. And in talking to her last night, she was saying that she is decrying the fact that so much of it is about funding. And she was very upset about that. And then in turn, talking to our Democratic Party chairman, Mark Kennedy, he was agreeing with that it is a lot about funding, and it does give those candidates an advantage. Just look at what Bob Vance was able to do, the Democrat candidate for Supreme Court Justice who ran against Roy Moore since August. In that little bit of time, they did have some money. I guess that the party sunk a lot of their advertising dollar into that campaign because they made an amazing push over such a short amount of time. And came up a little short, but that had everything to do with the amount of funding they were able to put into that race late.
And Heather, you were trying to say something. I'm sorry, I mean to cut you off.
Oh, that's all right. That's all right. I was just listening to what Morgan said, and I agree. We also had a very relatively small amount of people in West Virginia that voted for President Obama, about 35-36%. But they're, again, very passionate about that vote. You asked at the beginning of the conversation how people were feeling today, and I would say here in Pocahontas County, there's probably been an awful lot of long faces today that Mr. Obama won re-election. It was kind of interesting in the couple weeks before yesterday. I've been hearing comments from people that pretty much were blaming the Obama administration for everything, for every ill that had befallen them in the economy and everything else. I mean, even we had a recommendation from a peer review committee, made a recommendation to the National Science Foundation earlier this year to divest, for the NSF to divest its portfolio of the Green Bank Telescope here in Pocahontas County. Now, this is a billion-dollar scientific instrument that's really in its prime right now. It's only been in operation about 10 years. Just an invaluable piece of scientific equipment, so it's kind of had everybody scratching their head how they could make this decision. But my point is, that had nothing to do with the administration. They had no influence one way or another on that decision from the peer review group, yet that was being laid at the feet of the Obama administration as well. So,
right. So
I imagine a lot of people are not very, very happy about that. And I did want to touch on that the comment about the women voters. I agree. I mean, I have spoken to a lot of women voters who voted for Mr. Obama because of the missteps that the Republican Party has taken and because of the prevailing attitude that the Republican Party doesn't understand women's issues or they just don't care.
Is it Michael? Go ahead.
Yeah. Just a quick two comments. One, those people who did vote for President Obama, who spoke about that today, I think clearly stated that they weren't voting for more of the same. What they were hoping and wanting to convey in whatever other way they could was that something had to change, not only in the way that the two parties work together, the Congress, et cetera, but they were encouraging change on the part of the president himself. I just want to point that out, because people who were very supportive of Obama were also cautious to say, we want to temper this by saying, okay, you're going to get the vote, but we want you to do better. The second thing is that both R's and D's that I've spoken to, of all the figures out there that popped up one way or the other, the one that was most interesting in particular because of the last few days before the election was none other than Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey. There was no doubt that maybe because of a similar upturned independent spirit, they liked what he did. They may not, if pressed, say we always agree with his ideas, et cetera, but they liked how he operated.
And I just think that that may be something that will be played upon into the future.
Well, we look forward to continuing this in the coming weeks. This has been fascinating hearing the four of you talk about it from your perspectives, both politically and in terms of the regions that you come from. The voice you just heard is Michael Maluski, who is Chief Operating Officer at KVRF in Palmer, Alaska. He's a former city council member from Palmer. Heather Nyday is news director and host of the Noon Hour magazine at Allegheny Mountain Radio, serving the Allegheny Highlands and Virginia and West Virginia. Marcus Hiles is senior news correspondent for WVAS in Montgomery, Alabama. And David E., host of Hard Knock Radio, a daily drive-time hip-hop talk show from KPFA in Berkeley, California. And I want to thank all of you for being here on Beyond the Spin.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank
you.
Take care.
You're listening to Beyond the Spin, and I'm your host, Mark Steiner. And we'll be right back after this very quick break to discuss the impact of a Latino vote in this election. So don't go away. Welcome back to Beyond the Spin. This is Mark Steiner. We're about to talk to Dr. Pablo Rodriguez, who is co-founder and president of Latino Public Radio in Providence, Rhode Island, and host of the shows Nuestra Salud, Hablemos, and El Cuatro Poder. And Pablo Rodriguez, welcome back to Beyond the Spin.
It's great to be with you, Mark.
So this election, there's been a lot in this post-election conversation about the power of the Latino vote and what it played, that almost 10% of the electorate who voted in this election was Latino. 12.5 million Latinos voted. So talk a bit about what the power of this vote meant to you. What your analysis is of that?
I'm telling you, the meaning is for the entire country. Definitely, the issue of demographics, meaning destiny, is being evidenced clearly in this election. And as one Republican officer said, the grand old party is becoming the white old party, with Republicans really capturing the white old male vote, and Obama holding the coalition of people of color, women, and young people. And obviously, it has become a very powerful coalition. And not only that, when you look at the age groups of the Latino community and the immigrant community, and young people, then what you see is that as time goes by, this coalition is going to become more and more powerful. There'll be more Latinos becoming citizens. They have a higher reproduction rate, and as an obstetrician, for me, that's fantastic. And the average age of the Latino community throughout the country is in the 20s. So you're talking about not only a power now, but a growing influence in those states that determine the election, the so-called battleground states. And the percentages in those states of the Latino vote were just absolutely breathtaking. And I remember we had a show before when I was saying, you know, if Latinos come out to vote, it will be measurable. And they obviously listen, because they did come out in good numbers, but not even in the numbers that they could, because still it's about only 50% of the eligible voters in the Latino community that come out to vote. Imagine, just imagine what would happen if they would come out at the same level as the Anglo community, or even better, at the same level of participation that they exercise in their countries of origin, like in the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, and in countries where it's much more difficult to vote, but people come out in higher numbers. So this is a big wake up call to the Republican Party and to the Democratic Party. Like Congressman David Cicilline, who got elected here in Rhode Island, reelected, said this morning in my show, he said that you know, it's a wake up call to everyone, not just to Republicans, because Democrats also have a lot to answer, specifically when we talk about immigration reform.
And let's pick up on that point, because I think that if you look at both the ideas that that George Bush got 44% of the Latino vote in 2004 when he ran, this year the Democrats got an overwhelming, 76% of the Latino vote in America. but that the top issue was not, it was not immigration, but jobs. That was the second issue, was immigration. And that you know, that President Obama in the last few years has deported more than any other American president, but did the DREAM Act, but didn't give health care with the DREAM Act. And so we've got to see what he does. I mean, it's what I'm trying to say is here, it just seems as if the Latino vote in America, as complex as it is also up for grabs on some levels.
Absolutely. I think I agree 100% with you. And the interesting thing about President Obama is that 6 months ago, he drafted the executive order that developed the DREAM Act for young Latino immigrants that graduate from high school here in the United States that were brought in as children. I think that was the spark. I think that was the determinant moment in this campaign for the Latino vote. If he had not developed that executive order, I can guarantee you that the messages that the Republican Party was setting up throughout the battleground states in Spanish were completely directed at the fact that President Obama had become the deporter-in-chief. That's the word that they used in Colorado, in Nevada, about describing the immigration policy of President Obama. So this was a very timely decision by the president. What I foresee in the coming months, and if this happens, I am going to just throw a party. It's going to be that both Republicans and Democrats are going to be rushing in January to introduce immigration reform bills. I can bet my life on it.
You think they'll be very different bills, though? I think.
Oh yeah, they're going to be competing bills. The new contest in Congress is going to be quién es más Latino, who is more Latino, the Republicans or the Democrats. They're going to be fighting to get that attention. You know, it's great to be the belle of the ball.
But the belle of the ball has a lot of faces, as we talked about earlier, in our conversation before we went on the air here together, that Impre Media. Had a really good discussion of the breakout of the Latino vote, and it's a very different vote. I mean, if you look at in the Mexican American community, it went 78% for Obama, but if you look at the Cuban American community, it went for Romney by about 54% of the vote, if I have that right. Yeah, 54% went for Romney and in the Cuban community. And if you look at the Dominican community, which is large in Rhode Island and in New York and other parts of the United States, it went 96% for Obama. So this is a complex and diverse community. This is not – we have this kind of monolith we create around the Latino world, but it's not a monolith.
And you cannot pigeonhole Latinos anywhere. You know, I mean, the biggest mistake – that some of the politicians made in trying to speak to the Latino community with a single message is the fact that they didn't understand that complexity. For example, in Florida, Puerto Ricans are the ones that made the difference. The Puerto Ricans that live in the I-4 corridor, Orlando, Kissimmee, Tampa, the turnout was enormous. And Puerto Ricans are born citizens. For them, immigration is not a particularly important issue. But the way immigration is talked about touches us. When you speak about other Latino groups as roaches, as invaders, as not contributing to this country, it touches us. 60% of Latinos in this country can identify someone close to them that is an undocumented person. And therefore, it is an issue important if it doesn't affect us personally. And that's a nuance that many politicians have not been able to understand. Also in Florida, I think it's very clear that the myth of the Cuban vote is dead. I mean, this idea that somehow both parties are guilty of this, both Democrats and Republicans, feeling hostages to the politics of the old Cuban American community conservative, very anti-Castro, that is dead. That unicorn has been completely slain. You're going to be talking about a message towards the Puerto Rican community and towards the immigrant community and the new Cubans, because the younger generation are not as anti-Castro as the Cubans from the 1960s.
So it is. It's a really interesting changing landscape, and I think that I think whether it's Democrats or Republicans or whoever, I think that that people have to begin to understand the complexity of the Latino world. Whether, you know,
and just imagine Texas in 2016 and 2020.
Mm-hmm.
If present demographics continue to shift the way they are, Texas is going to battleground state. If the Republicans do not change their rhetoric, if they do not change the way they approach, the political way they approach, it's not just about commercials and you know, giving us tacos, but, you know, like they think that they can do. It's more than just commercials and outreach. It's about real policy decisions and policy proposals, what's going to change the attitude of the Latino community towards Republicans. If they don't do so, you imagine Texas as a battleground state. It's just,
yes.
The thought of it is mind-boggling, I'm sure, for strategists.
What we'll do, Dr. Pablo Rodriguez, in the next conversation we have with some others, is to pick up on that point. But let's talk about the future of Texas. I want to thank Pablo Rodriguez, co-founder and president of Latino Public Radio in Providence, Rhode Island, and host of the shows Nuestra Salud, Hablemos, and El Cuatro Poder, for being with us today on Beyond the Spin. Pablo, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
In addition to being a swing state for the presidential election, Colorado also had a number of controversial statewide and local ballot measures that were decided on Election Day. In Longmont, a city of about 80,000 people northwest of Denver, voters approved a ban on fracking within city limits. Maeve Conran, co-director of news at KGNU Community Radio Station in Boulder, Colorado, brings us this report.
More than $500,000 was spent by the oil and gas industry trying to defeat ballot issue 300 in Longmont. But on Tuesday night, that measure was approved by 60% of voters.
It's the first community that has done a citizen-initiated ban on fracking.
That's Kay Fissinger, campaign manager for Yes on 300. They raised about $25,000 from Longmont residents to fund the campaign. And despite being outspent 20-1 by the No on 300 campaign, on Tuesday night, they prevailed. But Fissinger acknowledges the fight is just beginning.
We're expecting that the industry and perhaps even Hickenlooper will mount a legal challenge to what we've done. We've expected that kind of thing all along.
Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, a Democrat and a former oil industry geologist, is already pursuing legal action against the city of Longmont over existing fracking regulations. Prior to Tuesday's election, he had said that he could foresee further legal action against the city should 300 be approved. Hickenlooper has been a supporter of the fracking industry, and this past February angered environmental groups around the state when he appeared in a radio ad for the oil and gas industry.
Hi, this is Governor John Hickenlooper. In 2008, Colorado passed tough oil and gas rules. Since then, we have not had one instance of groundwater contamination associated with drilling and hydraulic fracturing, and we plan to keep it that way. That's why Colorado recently passed the toughest and fairest hydraulic fracturing disclosure rule in the nation. In Colorado, we've proven that industry and the conservation community can come together to solve problems.
After that ad aired statewide, 13 environmental groups wrote to Hickenlooper disputing his assertion that Colorado has not had one instance of groundwater contamination associated with drilling and hydraulic fracturing. This year, Hickenlooper has expressed concerns over communities along the heavily populated Front Range of Colorado enacting moratoriums on fracking. He says the oil and gas industry creates jobs and should not be driven out of the state. Reacting to Question 300's approval this week, Hickenlooper says he expects the oil and gas industry to launch a legal battle with the city of Longmont. But that is something the anti-fracking activists not just expect, but welcome. Kay Fissinger.
Part of what we've been trying to do is to establish new case law. We welcome the suits that will come because we want the courts to recognize that there are constitutional rights involved in this. It's not just a matter of how we regulate the industry and who regulates the industry.
The fracking ban will be written into the state charter as soon as the election results are certified. Fissinger, city officials and the oil and gas industry expect that Longmont's fracking regulations will ultimately be decided in court. For Beyond the Spin at KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, this is Maeve Conran.
Thanks for tuning in to Beyond the Spin this week. And that's all we have time for today. I'd like to thank all of our guests. Michael Maluski, Chief Operating Officer of KVRF in Palmer, Alaska, and a former city council member in Palmer, Alaska. Heather Nide, News Director and host of the Noon Hour magazine at Allegheny Mountain Radio, serving the Allegheny Highlands of Virginia and West Virginia. Marcus Hiles, a Senior News Correspondent at WVAS in Montgomery, Alabama. Davey D., host of Hard Knock Radio, a daily drive-time hip-hop talk show on KPFA in Berkeley, California. And Dr. Pablo Rodriguez, co-founder and president of Latino Public Radio in Providence, Rhode Island, and host of the shows Nuestra Salud, Hablemos, and Lo Cuatro Poder. And thanks also to Maeve Conran, co-director of news at KGNU Community Radio in Boulder, Colorado, for her news story. And I'm your host, Mark Steiner, in Baltimore, Maryland, where I host The Mark Steiner Show at WEAA, a public radio station based at Morgan State University. Please join us again next week for more on Beyond the Spin. Beyond the Spin is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and WEAA, produced in association with the National Federation of Community Broadcasters. Our producer is Justin Levy. Our engineer at Center for Emerging Media is Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Please contact us with your thoughts and ideas, feedback, questions, or suggestions for Beyond the Spin at beyondthespin@gmail.com or facebook.com/beyondthespin or go to steinershow.org. You can hear a podcast of today's show. And for Beyond the Spin, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.